Want to know how Timothy Ferris made his book, The 4-Hour Workweek, into a number one New York Times bestseller? I know I did. That's why I called him up and I did this interview, and you're going to hear him explain that he discovered that bloggers were the way to go. They were the ones to help him build his audience, and he'll talk to you in this interview about how he connected with them. And I asked him questions to pull out the details so that if you have anything to promote, now I know you may not have a book right now, but if you have anything to promote, any reason to connect with bloggers, you're going to learn from him in detail how he did it, and you're going to be able to take his techniques and apply them to your own business, to your own idea, to your own startup. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, where I do interviews to learn how to build a better internet company, and in this interview, to learn how to promote that internet company. Here's my interview with Timothy Ferris. At what point in the writing process did you reach out to bloggers?
I reached out to certain bloggers as far as a year in advance of the book being published, but that was circumstantial. Those were writers I respected whose opinions I wanted to get about the writing process itself. So I actually interviewed about a dozen best-selling authors, people who had New York Times bestsellers, Wall Street Journal bestsellers, about the marketing of their books. And then secondly, best writing authors, Pulitzer Prize winners, Booker Award winners, about the writing process itself, which was actually a bigger concern for me. What I found out as I did that interview process is that many of the best-selling authors pointed to radio and blogs, and the blog impact was growing, whereas the radio impact was diminishing. So I decided at that point to focus on blogs. But the real inflection point was just after Christmas 2006. So my book came out end of April 2007. When I sat down, I remember very distinctly, a few days after Christmas, after recovering from a Toblerone overload, and started looking at how people were measuring influence online, and I realized that it was very poorly measured and tracked. But there were a few people who were going to be in Vegas for CES who I felt had a decent idea of what influence really constituted, and decided to go to Vegas to what was then at the Atomic Museum, a blogger meetup of sorts. But to give you an idea of how little I knew at that point, someone said, "I want to introduce you to Robert Scoble. You should meet Robert Scoble." And I had no idea who he was. Introduced us. We had nothing to talk about. I didn't want to bother Robert just because I then realized he was important in the blogosphere. So I said, "You know what, man? Everybody wants to talk to you. I don't have a really good question for you, so I'm not going to hassle you." And I just walked away at that point. And I think that comes, and it was at that point that actually some of Robert's friends invited me to go back to the blog house. And it was precisely because I didn't pitch them anything. I asked a lot of questions. So I think that this lesson indicates two things. And it was from that point that I came to know Miriam, Robert's wife, and a bunch of people who worked for PodTech, where Robert worked at the time, and really just hung out with bloggers, having drinks at the blog house and asking a lot of questions and being very obvious about the things I didn't know. So there are a couple of lessons to take away. Number one is that the least crowded channel for meeting high-profile bloggers is in person. Email is the most difficult channel, the most crowded. That's how they get pitched dozens, if not hundreds of times every day. I'm a top 1,000 blogger, not a top 100 blogger, and I get hundreds of pitches every week via email. Most of them I never even see because my assistant declines them. So in person is best. Second is that the best way to be interesting to bloggers is to be interested, whether that's in what they do, but you don't want to be a suck up. So it could be interested in the industry, the technology they know about, whatever that might be. And that will elicit them to ask questions about you, which is very important. And then thirdly, that your job is to convince them of the messenger, not the message, first and foremost. So if you come across as credible, curious, and self-deprecating when appropriate, ultimately they will then, in many cases, be willing to listen to what you have to say. But don't try to push the message until you've established yourself as someone they want to listen to or are willing to listen to.
You just went out there and you started out at this meetup in Vegas, and you were just walking up to bloggers and getting to know them?
For the most part, I really don't like cold approaches or cold calls, cold emails. So in most cases, it would either be a referral from someone else. So let's say I sat down and I'm having a few beers with someone who's involved with blogs. Maybe they're not a high level or a high traffic blogger, and I would ask them, who here do you think I should meet? Once they had an understanding of what I was doing and some of my ultimate objectives with the book, I'd say, if you were me, who would you want to meet? Do you know any of these guys? Who are the thought leaders, not just the traffic leaders? And we can talk about that in a second. That's a very important component and constituent to keep in mind. And if it was outside of that event, so once I went to Vegas, I realized that in person was really the absolute best approach to take, and that led me to also get in touch with South by Southwest, get in touch with Hugh Forrest at South by Southwest. And when you go to an event, also, if you approach the organizer knows everyone, and ask them who you should meet, and then you can use them as your conduit, your introduction, to people who might otherwise be too overwhelmed with people approaching them. And just to touch on the thought leader portion briefly, it's extremely, extremely difficult to have your product, book, service launch featured on a, let's just say, Technorati Top 100 blog. It is extremely difficult. It's if you just send a blanket pitch, a template pitch, like a press release, chances are it will not get picked up. Your objective should be to get a link to your site or a link to something related to whatever it is that you're discussing. And in order to do that, you just have to be interesting in a way that's specific to their audiences. So if you look at all of the initial big hits that I had, you'll notice a few things. Number one, they didn't come from traffic leaders. So they came from people who were well known in perhaps the design world, perhaps well known among a lot of the traffic leaders. This is important. And then I had a beer or two with a lot of the traffic leaders at some of these events, so they didn't think I was a complete idiot, maybe only a partial idiot. So they felt comfortable enough at that point, once someone they read who was a thought leader had written about me to link to me. Or if I did anything original content-wise or an interview with any of the traffic leaders, it was always specifically for their readers and oftentimes original content. I did not ask any of them to review my book. I never explicitly asked, to my memory, any of them to review my book. It was, here's a trend, here's a concept or a phenomenon that I think could be really fun to talk about with your readers. And then when they wanted to identify Tim Ferriss, my name was inevitably linked either to my page or to my Amazon book page. And that's all that you want. You don't have to think of it as a two or even three-step process. Don't try to put the sales pitch into content for well-known blogs. You wouldn't do it for like Esquire magazine or the Today Show. And blogs are very similar in that respect. They don't want to be seen as a shill or a hired gun. So give them the benefit of a very soft introduction to their readers.
Okay, I know we've got limited time, so let me pound you with a few questions here real
Yeah,
quick. First of
sure.
all, who were the thought leaders who you went to? Which blogs?
Well, there were a few. I met the one that comes to mind, just as an example right off the bat, Brian Oberkirk. Oberkirch, very smart guy, and he also has quite a few readers. But Merlin Mann reads him. A lot of the top guys out there read his stuff. And Brian and I were introduced. I think it was one of those chains where I asked one person at South by Southwest, who do you think I should meet? Who do you think I'd get along with? And that's a real important point. I would ask them, it wasn't just who do you think has the most traffic I should talk to. I really didn't ask that. I would say, who do you think I should talk to? Who do you think I'd really hit it off with? And I'd ask that in two or three, four people, and I had two people recommend I speak to Brian. And we spoke, we did hit it off. We did a podcast, which was a lot of fun and had a lot of good content in it. And that ended up getting on the front page of 43 Folders because it was linked to by Merlin. I've never been directly interviewed by Merlin or anything like that. I've met him a few times. He's a very cool guy, but it's never been direct. It's always been something indirect in that case.
You said that you got to meet Robert Scoble, mm-hmm. and that he was crowded with people. I've seen Robert Scoble. He's always got a pack of people around him. All the best bloggers do. How do you, Tim Ferriss, before your book, get to separate yourself from the crowd of other people who want to meet these bloggers?
It's a good question. The first is that your objective, again, is to establish the credibility of the messenger. And all that means is that the people close to Robert, who know Robert well, will say, yeah, this guy's okay. He's actually okay. He's pretty cool. Like, he's worth having lunch with. He's worth having a beer with. You can go up and try to pitch and be interesting and funny and so forth with 15 other people crowded around, but it's really a losing battle. So what I would do instead is, at the Bloghouse, for example, Robert was besieged with people asking him for things, asking for photographs and so forth. And I just sat back and I hung out with his coworkers and asked them questions, not just about Robert, but about blogs in general, life in general, got to know them, actually ended up spending time with them later. And it was sincere. I mean, I actually found them to be cool people. And at the end of the day, it wasn't about trying to make some elaborate sales pitch on the spot. It was about having the ability to send an email to someone who worked with Robert and say, hey, you know, would you mind maybe introducing us when he has some breathing room, and then making that step so that you can actually connect at a time when he doesn't have 15 people around him. So really thinking about it in terms of a series of steps. And you don't come off as someone who is just asking for something in return without providing any value that way also. Which is I think a fatal mistake that many people make. You know, they'll send an email to someone like Robert and they'll say, this is what I want you to do for me. And if that's your first introduction to him, Robert's actually very, very patient, but if somebody sends that to me, it gets deleted almost inevitably, and unless it is the absolute perfect match, which few things are.
Okay, what about the organizers? You said that organizers of events are good to get to know because they'll introduce you around. Why should the organizer care about you, Tim Ferriss, or care about the person who's listening to this and wants to duplicate your success?
The responsibility of the organizer is to make sure that people who come to the event are happy with the event. And I think especially at a tech event, there's a benefit to someone not knowing who you are from the standpoint of an organizer, meaning that you could have 100,000 readers. It's just that with the number of blogs out there, it's impossible to track all of them. You could have a very influential blog. But even that aside, the organizers are generally very interested in ensuring that people have a productive time at their conferences. And they recognize that being an idiot has far more punishment than taking 2 seconds to mention a few names. And they don't need to make a formal introduction. All you need really is if they say, I think you'd be interested in meeting this person, this person, this person. When you actually meet that person, you can say, so-and-so thought we might get along and hit it off. Rather than so-and-so told me to talk to you about my new book. It's too self-serving. It's too much of a sales pitch. You know, get to know people. And if it's not a fit, don't pitch them. But I encourage people to take a long-term view of this stuff. And you can also, it doesn't have to be the head organizer. It can also be a moderator of a panel, someone whose name is relatively known, but don't ask them for any particular favor specifically other than just indicating once you talk to them for a minute or two who they think you might hit it off with. And that's really about it. And someone whom you can learn from. And that was really my objective in going to these conferences. I figured that if I learned the playing field and I learned who knew whom, and the network and so forth, that I would then be treated more as an insider rather than an interloper or a salesman.
What kind of follow-up do you do after you meet somebody? Do you shoot them an email? Do you just add them to your address book? Do you read their blog and try to add comments? How do you stay in touch?
That's a good question. All right. So I actually do not go out of my way to stay in touch. I think that in the name of staying in touch, people can become a nuisance. And I was guilty of this for a long time, but not thankfully during this process. So I will, one of the biggest wastes of time you can make is to send an email the day or two either during a trade show or after a trade show, because everyone will be doing the same thing. So really what you're trying to do is separate yourself from the behavior that everyone else is subscribing to. So if you send an email the day after a conference, along with 1,000 others, they're just going to get archived. So I would wait a week or two and then send an email. Or wait a week or two and then say, hey, Robert, I don't think I did this with Robert, but making introductions. So if you meet 20 extremely interesting people, and let's just say you have a few superstars from Canada who are up and coming. This is actually a real example from my experience. And then you have some people who are established in the U.S. and they don't yet know each other. Make that introduction. So it's not about you. So 2 weeks later, I say, hey, I thought, I don't usually make a lot of introductions because I want to make sure it's a fit for people. But, you know, there's this guy I met, here's his site. I really think that you guys would have a lot to talk about. Might be worth a cup of coffee. Would you like me to make the introduction? And I'd send that to, the equivalent of Robert Scoble in this scenario. And that's it. And then maybe 2 weeks later, I mean, really, if you're going to ask for advice or something like that, don't do it right off the bat. But secondly, if it is a real fit, if they like you, if the content makes sense, chances are by the third or fourth contact, maybe even sooner, they'll say, hey, why don't you send me a copy of your book? Or why don't we do something when the book comes out? And that's how this happened in most cases, is I would be standing around a bunch of bloggers and just listening to them as they were having drinks. And I'd wander up in some cases to a group of guys. So let's say you want to walk up to, this is actually a real example, you want to talk to Merlin Mann. And Merlin's swamped by all these GTD fanatics. Then you walk up to this group of people, and even with the introduction, so-and-so thought we might hit it off. Do you mind if I stand here and just eavesdrop? I don't know anything about X, Y, and Z, but it'd be cool just to, buy a round of drinks for you guys and listen in. And they're going to say, fine, don't worry about it. And if you hear something you really don't know, ask a question. Ruby on Rails, what is that? I'm really sorry. I know I'm probably the only person here who doesn't know what that is. But be very honest about your shortcomings or things you don't know. And if you ask enough questions, and these have to be genuine questions, be interested to be interesting, right? But be genuinely curious, which I am, and I encourage people to be. At some point, someone's going to say, well, who the hell are you? Like, what exactly do you do? And then you say, oh, well, I've done this. You keep it really short, and I'm working on my first book, let's just say. And then you leave it at that. What's going to happen? Someone's going to ask, okay, well, what's it about? And so you have to become very good at navigating a conversation and allowing people to participate in pulling that information out of you so you don't seem like a salesperson. That is fatal. If you just sit there and give them a 3-minute pitch, I mean, some people will want that. Some people will ask for it because they really just don't have the patience to navigate that conversation. In most cases, it's much better to give less information and let other people ask you for more information. And then it's essentially their initiative and their idea. So that's also, there's a very good book called, first of all, I mean, there are scripts and things like that, sample scripts on my blog about contacting mentors. So if people, the approach is very similar. So if you look for how to contact George Bush or the chairman of Google on my blog, there are examples of that. But there's also a very good book called Confidential, which is written by a former CIA interrogator, actually, about how to elicit information, which is very interesting.
You said earlier that you ask for links to your site, not links to your book. What did you have up on your site at the time before the book came out? What were you asking for links for?
So I oftentimes wouldn't even ask for a link. It's just that if they're saying today's guest poster is, or I'm interviewing Tim Ferriss, they're going to link somewhere. So where are they going to link? And in this case, I was a virtual unknown online, so the only place that I really had any content was on my own site. I had a placeholder site, effectively, for the first month or two prior to book launch. This was actually a WordPress blog, and there are a few things I learned about blogs as well. Number one is that And this was a really good piece of advice from Rick Bruner, who used to work at DoubleClick. Might still be there, but it was acquired by Google. Very, very smart guy, very nice guy. And he said, a mediocre blog is more of a liability than no blog. So it's very helpful to have a blog when you're speaking to bloggers if you actually take it seriously. So don't put up a blog just to have a blog. Because if you have a post every 3 months or a half-assed post twice a week where it's just a link to some ridiculous YouTube video, it's a liability. It shows that it's sort of a me too attempt, and that's a bad thing. So I put up a WordPress blog a number of months before my book came out to really get familiar with the technology and to really start taking it seriously, and that's what it linked to. There's a very short and effectively a couple of blog posts, but about 2 weeks prior to the book coming out, the real book page went up, which is still up. I mean, if you go to 4hourworkweek.com, you can see that main page. I've since come to the decision, number one, that my face needs to be removed from that homepage, but number two, that you really don't need anything other than a well-designed theme on, let's say, WordPress. I'm a huge WordPress fan, and if I could redirect 4hourworkweek.com to my blog page without screwing up all of my ranking and page rank and so forth and so on, which I may do at some point, I would do that. So I think using a content management system like WordPress from the outset is the way to go, easily.
Okay, I've got two other questions. Yep. First is, what other social media do you use beyond blogs?
So I am on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn. I really don't use them for much just because they've become very unwieldy monsters. I mean, I have something like 3,000 friends on Facebook, and it's just too much. It turns into another inbox. So unfortunately, many of these networks force you to have another inbox. They allow people to direct message you or whatnot. So same for Flickr, same for YouTube. I really don't respond to much email through any of those or messages through any of those. And it ends up being more of a hindrance and creating more mental drag than anything else. Although with, let's say, 3,000 followers on Facebook, if there is something I want to promote, or promote sounds like a dirty word, it's not. I mean, if there's something that I want to make people aware of, like a party that I'm holding in Madrid or something like that, it's still useful. Or if I want to get an indication of what my demographics look like, very, very helpful. But Twitter, I would say, is I just actually entered the top 100 Twitter users in the world today. So it's good timing. Thanks.
Based on how many friends you have on, followers, I mean, you have on there?
Yeah, or based on number of followers. And Twitter is very interesting to me. I used to be a huge critic of Twitter because I felt like it was just pointless email on steroids. You know, I had this burrito for lunch. Oh my God, I have gas. I mean, that type of message, which a lot of it is. But Twitter has really evolved. There are newspapers being published through Twitter. There are political activists using Twitter. The way I use it is as a micro blogging platform. So if there is something, a random suggestion or a time-sensitive announcement or observation that really doesn't warrant putting together an entire blog post, because I want to be respectful of crowding people's RSS readers and inboxes, then I'll put it on Twitter. And I also use Twitter as a diary, effectively. So if I go on a road trip and want to keep track of what I'm doing, what I'm visiting, I'll just put it on Twitter so people can follow it. But at the same time, I have number one, a limited amount of space, so I limit the amount of bullshitting that I do. And number two, I have a chronology of everything that I've done. So I really use it for myself almost as a diary, and then number two, for others as a micro-blogging announcement-type platform. And that's worked really well for me. Controversially, I don't follow anyone. And you know, for those people interested, if they search Twitter on the blog, I go through the many, many reasons why I don't do that. But it works, and I do respond to people with direct messages fairly often, and I do read my replies.
But of all the social media tools out there, blogging is number one, and second is Twitter. Everything else is a far third.
For the purposes, I mean, we have to say for what purpose, right? So if we're talking
connecting
about
connecting with people,
I don't, So I don't believe there's intrinsic value in connecting with people. I think that you need to have, I think it needs to be more specific than that. So some people might say, oh my God, you don't follow any of your friends on Twitter. Well, I have more than 6,000 friends on Twitter. I don't think it's possible to maintain anything that could be called a friendship with 6,000 people. And I have had emails from people who reply to all of their email they get, and they spend 16, 19 hours a day on email. And inevitably, it's like two or three words per email. And I don't really view that as much communication. So with connecting with people who are interested in the content or the ideas that I have, I think blogging, number one, by far and away the most effective. But it also has the highest barrier to entry, so to speak. It's hard to distinguish yourself in the world of blogs. And then Twitter, number two. I think there's probably more opportunity for someone on Twitter, although it's not as search engine friendly in some cases as, let's say, WordPress. So it's a balancing act. But of everything that I've used, if I want to make things happen, if I want to instigate social change, if I want to bring people to a party or do just about anything, recommend a book or anything like that, then it's going to be the blog and Twitter.
Finally, you said earlier that you kept asking bloggers for introductions to people who you should meet. Let me ask you for an introduction. Who should I meet if I want to learn how to promote my projects online?
Depends what type of projects, because the tools and approaches vary greatly. If you're promoting a service versus a blog versus a book versus a newsletter, the approaches are all very different. But I mean, I would really recommend no one person comes to mind. But if you can find whoever's the most successful at that, I would recommend, first and foremost, if they have a blog, look at their blog and really look closely at the design. So I think form and function are paired very closely. I don't think you have to sacrifice form for function necessarily. And so if you look at the current design of my blog, for example, a lot of the elements are borrowed from ProBlogger.net, which would be the sort of JavaScript tabbed most popular function. A lot of the layout is similar to Zen Habits and certain elements from Copy Bloggers. So these are all top 100 blogs that have some material or content overlap with me. And I know all three owners of those sites, and we have similar philosophy of how we like to work and what our objectives are. So I was able to not reinvent the wheel, but simply borrow certain design elements that also were functional. Having my Twitter status on the right-hand side of my blog would be another example. And incorporate them and then test them using not only Google Analytics, but also CrazyEgg is a very useful tool, crazyegg.com, for looking at heat maps and where people are clicking from different URLs. And then simply refining from there. So that was the approach that I took, and I think that's also an approach. If you have an equivalent of, let's just say, TechNerdy Top 100, and I know it's a flawed metric in a lot of ways, so you can look at Compete or Podcast if you want, but find who those top players are and look at how they're doing things, because I think almost without exception, most of the people now who are at that level do a lot of analytics and a lot of testing, so there's no reason to reinvent the wheel and repeat what has already been done.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on the phone with me and letting me interview you, and thanks for all this time.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. All right, well, I'm gonna run. I'm headed to the airport in about 2 hours. But thanks very much. Let me know when it goes up.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Bye.
All right. Have a good one. Bye-bye.